Welcome to another episode of Life Excellence with Brian Bartus. Join me as I talk with amazing athletes, entrepreneurs, authors, entertainers, and others who have achieved excellence in their chosen field, so you can learn their tools, techniques, and strategies for improving performance and achieving greater success. Dr. Barry Franklin is Director of Preventative Cardiology and Cardiac Rehabilitation at Corewell Health, formerly known as Beaumont Health, in Royal Oak, Michigan. As a professor of physiology and internal medicine, his research interests include the prevention of heart disease, cardiovascular risk reduction, obesity and metabolism, exercise testing, and lifestyle medicine. Dr. Franklin is also a prolific author and speaker. He has written or edited nearly 700 publications, including 547 papers, 100 book chapters, and 27 books. He has also narrated 42 educational videos. Since 1976, he has given over 1,000 presentations around the world, both within and outside the medical profession. In addition to his primary vocation in medicine, Barry has been engaged for the past four decades in the study of highly successful people in all walks of life. He has presented his findings in a college course, an escalating number of media and speaking invitations, and commencement addresses at major universities. Most recently, Barry published his 27th book titled GPS for Success: Skills, Strategies, and Secrets of Superachievers. I'm super excited for this conversation, and I'm thrilled to have him on the show. Welcome, Barry, and thanks for joining us on Life Excellence.
Brian, thanks for the invitation. I've followed your work as well, and this should be a real kick tonight, working on this spotlight, so to speak.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And I look at the show as a double feature, which is unusual actually for our podcast, because I definitely want to discuss your research on superachievers. But of course, I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about heart health. I think many of us know someone who has had a cardiac event, maybe a fatal cardiac event. I certainly have. And the frustration I have, Barry, is that heart disease is largely preventable. How is it that even though we know more than ever about heart disease and prevention, cardiovascular diseases are still the leading cause of death, not just in the United States, but globally? And I've got a couple statistics. According to the CDC, one person dies every 33 seconds in the United States from cardiovascular disease. And the World Health Organization reports that an estimated 17.9 million deaths occur globally each year. Where's the disconnect between education and action?
Brian, your question is an excellent one, and I've been doing this since my hair was black, so this goes back a lot of years. You're exactly right. Coronary disease is largely preventable. The best statistics indicate that of every 500 individuals, only one to five and no more really have a genetic predisposition to develop coronary artery disease. So you're exactly right. It's largely preventable. Cardiovascular disease is the major killer and crippler in our society. We have about 800,000 heart attacks every year. Many are fatal. We also have more than 300,000 what we call sudden cardiac deaths. Your friend is here today and gone tomorrow. That high-risk group, by the way, is men 55 to 65 years of age. I think a major important factor is people need to know their numbers. We now know unequivocally that risk factors predispose to acute coronary events or heart attacks. In fact, 75 to 90% of all heart attacks are now explained by existing risk factors. So that's critically important. If you say, Barry, so what's the take-home message? The take-home message is, I tell my patients, know your numbers. In other words, what's critical? Diabetes. What's your glucose? What's your hemoglobin A1C, which of course tells the docs over 3 months how good is your blood sugar? Are you hypertensive? Are you obese? We look at BMI. BMI, as you well know, above 30 indicates obesity, but above 35, a markedly heightened risk for cardiac events, and sudden cardiac death. We have good news, and that good news is even for the overweight and obese individuals, if they lose just 5% of their body weight, there are substantial health benefits. Smoking. Cigarette smoking, if you say to me, Barry, what's number one? I would say number one would be cigarette smoking. In other words, lifetime smokers lose on average, Brian, 10 to 12 years. It's not weeks, that's not months, that's years of their life by cigarette smoking. Just living with a cigarette smoker is a 30% greater likelihood of developing coronary disease. Cholesterol is critically important. My mentor, Bill Roberts, recently passed away at 92, director of the Baylor Heart Institute, said to me on a plane trip one time, Barry, remember the rule of 40. And I said, what's that, Dr. Roberts? And he said, for every 40 points, you lower your cholesterol, you cut your risk in half. So, Brian, if your cholesterol is 280 and you take it down to 240, you cut your risk in half of a heart attack. If you take it from 240 down to 200, you cut your risk in half. Take it from 200 to 160, you've cut your risk in half again. We also have powerful drugs today, statins, that can lower cholesterol markedly. If you're intolerant to statins, there is a new drug called PCSK9 inhibitors that lower the bad LDL cholesterol by about 50%, lower mortality by about 50%. And last but not least, we want your fitness to be higher, if possible, above what we call 5 METs, and we'll talk about this later in the discussion. But above 5 METs markedly reduces the risk of acute coronary events. So those are the key things. Last but not least, bad genes double the risk of acute coronary events. So if you pick the wrong parents, you double the risk. On the other hand, a favorable lifestyle cuts it in half. So I now tell patients, combine lifestyle, combine it with pharmacotherapies, and remember the 10 most empowering two-letter words. If it is to be, it is up to me, you the patient.
Barry, you've devoted your entire medical career to preventative cardiology and cardiac rehabilitation. And I love that you're talking about prevention rather than talking about treating after a cardiac event or treating disease with drugs after the fact. I love the idea, and I've known about you for a long time, and it's always impressed me that you are focused on prevention rather than treatment. So you gave a whole list of things that we ought to be doing. Help us to understand, because I think a lot of people don't go to the doctor. They maybe don't even have a primary care physician, but they're certainly not as preventative oriented as you are. So what should we be doing in terms of screenings and checkups? And again, you've mentioned some things. So I'm talking about timing of certain tests or timing of screenings. And at what age should we really begin this regimen? You gave a statistic that actually hit kind of close to home when you said 55 to 65, because I won't say my age, but I fall on the lower side of that range. So help us to understand more specifically what it is that we should be doing and when.
Well, I think the most important thing is a regular physical exam. And on that regular physical exam, Brian, you're going to get blood chemistry studies, you're going to get an EKG, you're going to get blood pressure measured. And those studies provide tremendous insights in terms of an individual's risk for cardiovascular disease. I think it's also important to note, I see patients every day, and a lot of times I'll see a guy 60, 65, and say, well, I don't have heart disease. And unfortunately, I know the research. And the research, two major studies say if you're over 50, one study said 45% of the people have underlying heart disease. Another study from the Cleveland Clinic said 85%. In other words, if you grew up on Ben and Jerry's and McDonald's and so on and so forth, those dietary habits, you're at much greater risk, no question about it. So recognize that if you're over 50 in the U.S., you've probably got underlying heart disease, even though you have no major symptoms. Recognize genetics does play a role. Recognize that a favorable lifestyle cuts the risk in half.
So we're in agreement that cardiovascular disease is largely preventable and that we can at least mitigate the risk of cardiovascular disease through lifestyle. What can we do in terms of diet and exercise to prevent heart disease?
Whenever I meet with patients, the first thing I say is a positive thing. I'd like you to eat 6 to 8 servings of fruits or veggies every day. And number two, don't leave the breakfast table unless you've had 2 servings. So if you said to me, Barry, what'd you have this morning? I had Cheerios with some blueberries on it. I had a glass of V8 vegetable juice, low sodium, and I had a banana. So I left the breakfast table, Brian, with 3 of the minimum 6 servings that we're talking about. Drink more water. Eat fish, chicken, turkey. Ideally, the piece of meat should be the size of your palm. It shouldn't be this big. It should be very, very small, complemented with cauliflower, broccoli, carrots, and so on and so forth. Avoid sugar-sweetened beverages. Avoid even diet colas. Drink more water. Stay away from processed, unprocessed meats. Bill Roberts, editor of the AJC, who I mentioned earlier, said we fatten our cows and pigs, we kill them, we eat them, and then they kill us. How sobering. Stay away from fatty meats. Too much salt is not good. I have some patients that say, well, I don't salt the food. And my answer is 75 to 80% of the salt you eat is already in the food. So it's important for you or your wife or spouse to look at labels. Here's a simple rule, Brian. Look at the calories per serving. Look at the milligrams of salt. A really healthy food has about the same number. Let me give you an example. I'll eat Skinny Pop popcorn. It's 150 calories per serving, 110 milligrams of salt. That's a fairly good food along those lines. Stay away from excessive amounts of alcohol. Stay away from bakery goods, cookies, cakes, pies, punchkes, donuts, cinnamon rolls. All that stuff contains trans fats, which in my humble opinion is the worst kind of fat, even worse than in meat. So those are probably the key things. Salads are great, but you can ruin a salad with Roquefort or blue cheese dressing. You want to use vinaigrettes or you want to use oil and vinegar. Relative to your question on exercise, we now know 30 minutes of moderate intensity exercise on most days of the week can reduce the risk of cardiac events by up to 50%. If you want to do more vigorous exercise, don't start with that, but gradually start with walking and gradually increase the intensity. 20 minutes of vigorous exercise 3 to 4 days a week is just enough. Always use a warm-up. Always use a cool-down. We recommend people use what's called perceived exertion. That's a chart that goes from 6 to 20. Ideally, we want you ranking the exercise as fairly light to somewhat hard. Shouldn't feel hard or very hard. Complement that with flexibility, with resistance training, and recognize that for the average person starting an exercise program, this is critically important, Brian, you want to be training above 3 METs. That's multiples of the resting metabolic rate. So you and I talking here today are each at 1 MET. You say, Barry, what is 3 METs? 3 METs is equivalent to walking on the flat at 3 miles an hour. Or if you say, well, that's too fast for me, walking at 2 miles an hour up a 3.5% grade. That gets you out of the high-risk group, what we call the bottom 20%, the least fit, the least active, the highest-risk subset. And last but not least, exercise is most dangerous or risky for the person with known heart disease or hidden heart disease who once a year or once every decade goes out and play vigorous racquetball or goes out to shovel his driveway full of heavy, wet snow. So it's that sporadic, unaccustomed, high-intensity exercise in somebody with known or hidden heart disease, the relative risk of a cardiac event can increase more than 100-fold. Those are the keys.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. There's a lot there, both on the diet side and on the fitness side. As you were talking, I was thinking about how contrary everything that you were saying is to how the average American lives. And so I think in many respects, you're preaching to the choir with our audience. Our listeners and viewers, I think, tend to be healthy and fit, and they're developing themselves both personally and professionally. But there's a very large segment of the population, no pun intended, that isn't engaging in a healthy lifestyle, whether we're talking about diet or fitness. And I'm sure you encounter a lot of those folks because they end up coming to you post-cardiac event. And so how do we go from the couch or recovery after a cardiac event to the lifestyle that you were talking about for the last few minutes?
I think for the most part, we've got to make it simpler and we've got to put greater responsibility on the part of the patient. Brian, I see people all the time and say, I see the best cardiologist. Everybody's got the best cardiologist in the city. Okay. And I say, how often do you see him or her? And they go, oh, I go see him once a year for my regular appointment. And my answer is, how long do you spend with him? Well, I spend usually 20, 30 minutes in the office, some time with the PA, some time with the nurse clinician, and then usually 5, 8, 10 minutes with the doctor. My answer is, what are you doing 16 waking hours a day, 7 days a week? Because that's far more important than the 5 or 8 or 12 minutes you spend with a doctor per se. The other problem in medicine today is many doctors see 12 to 20 patients a day. Many, on a bad day, can see 40 or 50 patients. They can write a script to increase the cholesterol medication. They can recommend a diagnostic study, but they're not doing the diet, the exercise, or smoking cessation. Those are things that the patient has to take responsibility for. You heard it first here. I predict increasingly healthcare providers will put greater responsibility on the part of the patient. You're responsible for your job. You've also got to be responsible for your health. We can't have people coming into the office and saying, oh, I'm not diabetic. We'll check their blood sugar. Brian, it's 170. How many years have they been walking around as diabetic? So more of the responsibility has to go to the patient. We've got to adjust things so we incentivize patients to hold their weight or lower their weight, exercise regularly, stop smoking, eat healthier. And I think that's going to be a key message in terms of the future of changing medicine.
And so if you say that to somebody and they respond, okay, I'd like to do that, but I don't know where to begin. I don't exercise at all. I don't eat particularly well, but I'm interested in doing that. Can you provide just some basic tools to get started? How can I get off the couch and start doing something? Because I think what happens is people, you know, we hear about diets and diets are extreme sort of by definition, right? So I'm going to go on this diet and I've eaten, whatever I eat, you know, 3 hamburgers every meal and a bunch of potato chips or French fries or whatever it is, processed foods. And now I'm going to go on a diet and I'm just going to eat a lettuce and carrots and no salad dressing. And somebody does that for about one meal, obviously, and it's not sustainable. On the fitness side, somebody says, okay, I've never really exercised. I mean, I did when I was in middle school, but I'm 45 years old now and I'm overweight and I've never really exercised, but I'm going to go out and I'm going to run 5 miles, right? They haven't run since seventh grade. And it's not sustainable. So people go out and they try to do something and of course they hate it and they stop doing it immediately. So where, again, I'm sure you encounter patients like that. And so how do you get them on the right track and starting out with something that's doable, that's easy to do, that isn't overly cumbersome, and a way that they can get a small win, whether we're talking about diet or fitness, and lead them on the road to health?
I think first and foremost, how we counsel patients, clients, is critically important. Although I'm not a psychologist or a trained behavioral therapist, there are certain principles called motivational interviewing or readiness to change that can help us guide the patient according to where he or she is ready to make those changes. I think another disservice is the national guidelines discourage the hell out of people when it says you've got to do this, 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 this. If you came to me and you said, Barry, how much exercise do I need? And I'd say, Brian, what are you doing? And if you said nothing right now, believe it or not, I would say to you, Brian, can you give me 10 minutes three times a week for 4 weeks? And you'd probably look at me and say, well, I just read in the New York Times that they say you need 60 minutes on 5 days a week. And I say, Brian, can you give me 10 minutes three times a week? I can't tell you the number of times I gave that advice. And I'd see somebody a month later and they say, Doc, I didn't follow your advice. And I said, what do you mean you didn't follow? You didn't follow the 10? No, they said the first day I did 12 minutes and the next day I did 14 minutes. And I'm now up to 30 some minutes, 5 days a week. A body at rest, key point, body at rest tends to remain at rest. A body in motion tends to remain in motion. I want to get them moving and I don't want to discourage the heck out of people. So we tend to use downscale goals for lunch. For example, you tell me exactly what you're eating and I'll say, can you add two or three fruits or vegetables throughout the day? That's it right now. Can you do that? Yeah, I can do that. Can you gradually move them in that direction? You want to make it as simple, as easy, and as accessible as you possibly can. You don't want to discourage people. And you want to counsel them according to where they are on the, what we call the readiness to change scale. So they may need some counseling. They may need some additional encouragement. But I think small changes over time can have a big impact. I've seen it in my own practice.
I really appreciate that. So do something, take action. However small is better than taking no action at all. And by the way, that's true in areas other than just health and fitness, isn't it? You mentioned METs, metabolic equivalents, and I know that's a big hot topic. I see that phrase everywhere. And so now, and maybe this is for folks who are more physically fit, but tell us more about what that is in the significance relative to cardiovascular disease. And specifically, I'm wondering how do we incorporate that into our tracking? If we keep track, it seems like rather than minutes or miles, if we're talking about running, now there's a lot of emphasis on METs. Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, let's first start off with the definition. The definition of MET is a metabolic equivalent. It's the amount of oxygen you consume at rest. And if we measure thousands of people like I have, it's about 3.5 milliliters of oxygen per kilogram body weight per minute, 3.5 ml per kg per minute. Brian, if I had you on our treadmill and we're measuring oxygen consumption and you're at a fairly low workload and I get 14 ml per kg per minute, what does that mean? You're at 14 ml per kg per minute. One met is 3.5. If I take 14 divided by 3.5, you don't need calculus or algebra here. 14 divided by 3.5, Brian's working at what we call 4 mets. He's increased his energy expenditure fourfold. We can measure mets directly or we can estimate it based on what speed and grade you're on the treadmill or if you're on a stationary bicycle. We know, for example, that if you're walking at 2 miles an hour, Brian, it's 2 mets. 3 miles an hour is 3 mets, the rule of 2 and 3 miles an hour. You said, what about singles tennis? It's about 7 mets. What about jogging at 6 miles an hour is about 10 mets. We use that for this reason. If I did a treadmill test on you, Brian, and I know you're much higher than this, but let's say we had a 5 met capacity. And you said to me, Barry, I want to go back to playing singles tennis. Singles tennis is on average 6 to 7 mets. I'd say, Brian, you're going to be able to play that, but I don't think it's realistic right now because your capacity on our treadmill test is only 5. I don't think it's safe and effective. Clinical applications, we basically use then the treadmill test to determine, can somebody do this activity or not? Last but not least, the maximal METs on a treadmill is very insightful. So if I put you on our treadmill and you reached 10 METs, that means you'd be consuming 35 ml per kg per minute. In general, Brian, very, very important, the higher the METs on a treadmill test, the better the prognosis, the less likely to develop cardiovascular disease. Each MET reduces your risk of a cardiac event by 15 to 20%. Each MET higher on the fitness continuum. So that's critically important. A lot of the doctors prescribe aspirin, statins, and beta blockers. For your information, each one of those reduces cardiac events by about 20%. You get almost the same thing with, I'm not saying throw the aspirin, beta blockers, and statins out. I'm saying complement it by raising your fitness level so you get the best of both worlds. As a general guideline, we want your fitness to be over 5 METs. That gets you out of the high-risk group. And lastly, just for your listeners, your viewers, a good friend of mine in Australia has developed a formula to estimate METs based on heart rate. It's called the Wicks formula after the scientist John Wicks. And basically, it calculates METs as the following. 6 times the heart rate index minus 5. The heart rate index, Brian, is your exercise heart rate divided by your resting heart rate. So if you said to me, Barry, I play singles tennis, and I get my heart rate typically up to 140. And I say, Brian, what's your resting heart rate? You said, about 70. 140 exercise heart rate divided by 70 is 2. 2 times 6 is 12 minus 5 is 7. I'd estimate your METs at around 7 METs when you're playing singles tennis with an exercise heart rate of 140, resting heart rate 70. So that's how some of the clinical applications that we use. Most fitness devices do not track METs, to tell you the truth. I'll tell you what's nice is many of the treadmills can estimate METs. You can put the grade and speed in and the treadmills, and the most accurate device for estimating METs is the treadmill. And many of the treadmills show that right on. Yes. Sure. I still think risk factors, Brian, are underestimated. As I said, 75 to 90% of all events can be predicted based on the risk factor profile. I do believe coronary calcium, the coronary calcium score, is increasingly utilized in the United States. And the reason for that, it provides independent and additive information beyond the risk factor profile in terms of it quantitates the calcium in the coronary arteries, and we know that that calcium is a forerunner for cardiac events. So in general, Brian, the higher the calcium, the greater the likelihood of acute coronary events. Classic study I oftentimes cite. They looked at a large cohort of men and women. These are all men and women who were symptom-free but had many risk factors. They measured coronary calcium. They followed these men and women for about 3 years, and they looked at how many had heart attacks, how many died suddenly. What they found were 3 major findings. Number one, as I said, the higher the coronary calcium score, the greater the likelihood of a cardiac event. Number two, people ask me all the time, well, my coronary calcium score was this or my coronary calcium score was that. If your coronary calcium score, Brian, is 0, your likelihood of having a cardiac event is less than 1% over the next 10 years. 10 years, not year, 10 years, okay? If your coronary artery calcium score is 1 to 99, your risk over the next 10 years is 20%. If it's 100 to 400, your risk is 40%. And if it's over 400, you got a 50% likelihood in the next 10 years for experiencing an acute cardiac event, a heart attack. What was also insightful from this study is if your coronary calcium was over 100, you had a greater risk than the average patient who has known coronary artery disease. So the coronary calcium score can be very insightful. And if the current coronary calcium score is high, those are the people who need to be on aspirin, beta blockers, statins, regular exercise, etc. The other hot topic today is what's called lipoprotein A, LP little a, which is a component of the LDL, which I call the lousy cholesterol, which really deposits inside those arteries. We now know from a variety of studies, if you get a heart attack under the age of 60, more often than not, when they go back and look at the LP little a, it was elevated. What's the problem with this LP little a? It does several things that are not good. It promotes oxidation of LDL cholesterol, the lousy cholesterol, which means it helps it get inside your vessel wall. Bad news. Secondly, it promotes higher levels of inflammation. Thirdly, it promotes the tendency for blood to clot. Study after study after study shows if your LP little a is elevated, you're at higher risk for a cardiac event. Then you might say, okay, what's the cut points? Many people, many doctors recommend an LP little a under 30 milligram per deciliter. Some people are even more aggressive today and say it should be under 20. So those are two hot emerging areas in preventive cardiology.
And how often should those be measured?
I think once every 2, 3, 4 years would be fine. The LP little a, I would probably do more often.
Okay. So the coronary calcium, tell us how that gets administered. How is that tested?
It's a scan. It's an injection and it's a scan and it's rapidly determined and they can determine the level of coronary calcium in the arteries. Once again, you're hoping for zero. That's somebody who doesn't need aspirin, statins, beta blockers. On the other hand, if it's higher, then the individual cardiologist will adjust the regimen depending on what the coronary calcium score is and what the other risk factors are.
And you're saying that that should be measured every 2 to 3 years,
a coronary calcium? I think that's reasonable. Yes.
Okay. Good. Barry, we were talking before the show, and I mentioned that I've known your role in healthcare for several years. I've had the privilege of hearing you speak, and that talk was actually the catalyst for my proactive stance toward heart health specifically, but also more generally on health, fitness, and eventually the study of longevity. But I had no idea until recently, and you've been doing this apparently for about 40 years or more than 40 years. I've been doing it for longer than 30 years, that we share another passion, and that's the study of superachievers, highly successful people in all walks of life. Tell us what led you to explore the secrets of superachievers and how your research developed into far more than just a fleeting hobby.
Well, I became very, very interested in 1967, Brian. I was a gymnast at Kent State University. My goals at the time were I worked on steel rings. My goals at the time were twofold: what new trick I was going to learn on the steel rings, and what attractive co-ed I was going to take out over the weekend. Those were my goals. And I got to the senior year at Kent State, and I realized those goals are leading me nowhere. I'm not going to have a meaningful career. I'm not going to be financially stable. So I said, I need more education. So I decided to get a master's degree from the University of Michigan. By the way, we'll leave this for a different topic, but I got into Michigan with a 2.7 acum from Kent State University, which is unprecedented. I'll tell you if you want to know later how I did it. Then I got into Michigan. Then I got into Penn State. I had 10 years of education, got out in the real world working at Millard Fillmore Hospital, Buffalo, New York. And I realized that 10 years of education had prepared me poorly for the real world of work. I lacked what I call, and you call probably, soft skills. let me just go through these. Power, positive associations and collaboration, people skills. I wasn't a good writer. I wasn't a good speaker. I didn't know anything about goals. I didn't really think about goal setting, serving others, dealing with setbacks. I didn't appreciate the virtues of patience and persistence. I didn't appreciate the potency of preparedness, prepare. I didn't understand the laws of attraction and the laws of sow and reap. I didn't understand how valuable being a member of an organization could be. And I didn't understand the number one success principle, in my opinion, which is taking action. Get off your butt and move in the direction of your goals. I also became fascinated at the time, Brian, with a guy, and I know you know this guy, Peter Drucker. And Peter Drucker, management guru, business guru, said, and this was in my 20s, 30s, everybody should have a secondary pursuit. My primary pursuit was physiology, rehab, and so on. But everyone should have a secondary pursuit and make it more than just a hobby. I decided to study, in my 20s, highly successful people. I became fascinated with people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and Tiger Woods and Gary Player, and so the list goes on and on and on. I read countless books that I'm sure you've read, Think and Grow Rich. I read How to Win Friends and Influence People, and so on and so forth. But the most important thing that really influenced me was a writer by the name of Tolstoy. And Tolstoy said, the most important knowledge is that which helps you guide the way you lead your life. And unfortunately, all the university courses that you and I took didn't teach us those kinds of things. So I started reading everything I could on leadership, success strategies, and you know what? This stuff works.
It certainly does. And you've mentioned some of these already, but what are some of the common success traits or characteristics that you've discovered among superachievers in your research?
As I look at superachievers, I found in my research three foundational factors. Number one, they love what they do. The late Steve Jobs said, if you haven't found what you love to do, keep looking, because you're never really going to be highly successful. Number two, take 100% responsibility for your life. I hate it when people say the manager didn't like me or this one didn't. You got to find the way to do it. And I was going to talk one time on self-responsibility, Kent State University 30 years ago, and a student came up and she said, Dr. Franklin, do you know the 10 most empowering two-letter words? And I said, I don't have a clue. And she said, if it is to be, it is up to me. I can't tell you the number of times I say that to people. And three, focus on serving others. Talk to young people. I want a big car. I want to travel the world. I want to be. My answer is you're focusing on the wrong end of the scale. Focus on your contributions and the rewards will come via boomerang effect. 10 specific behaviors. Number one, be an optimist. Look for the good in people and situations. Number two, radiate, exemplify what I call HOG, which is happiness, optimism, and gratitude. Number three, be a goal setter. Number one factor, be a goal setter. Famous study, Lewis Terman, 1921, looked at high IQ students, looked at their grades, looked at success in life. Grades, IQ weren't factors for success. Perseverance, self-confidence, and the number one factor was setting goals. So I started setting goals years and years, and I write them down. It's not just a matter of setting goals. Take action every day to achieve your goals. There's a guy, and I know you know him, by the name of Tommy Hopkins. He's trained more salespeople than anybody in the world. He coined the law of Goya. Get off your ass and move in the direction of achieving your goals every day. Be persistent. Recognize, and you know this, that setbacks line the road to success. I've studied Edison, who had 8,400 setbacks. I studied Lincoln, who lost 8 elections before becoming president. I've studied Colonel Saunders, who had more than 1,000 rejections for his chicken recipe, Kentucky Fried Chicken, although, as an aside, Colonel Saunders kept a lot of us in cardiac rehab in business over the years.
He sure has. and still
ask,
is.
Ask for what you want. Don't, people can't read your mind. You want to be on that program or you want to do this? Ask them. Become a master communicator. I love Malcolm Gladwell when he said, you want to get good at something, you got to devote 10,000 hours to it. That applies to speaking or writing or whatever. 10,000 hours, 20 hours a week for 10 years or 10 hours a week for 20 years. That's a lot of time. Power of positive associations, collaborations, and relationships. Collaborations in particular are critically important. I heard movie director Steven Spielberg interviewed one time, and they said, Spielberg, you're a genius. How do you do all these great movies? And he said, very simple. You want me to do your movie? Got to hire two guys. Steven Spielberg, but a friend of mine by the name of George Lucas, because George makes me look good. Guys who did Chicken Soup for the Soul, Canfield and Hanson, two average writers. They combine their skills. They've sold about 750 million books today in Chicken Soup for the Soul. Exhibit great people skills. Be nice to people. Be a person of integrity. I'll tell you something else that is critically important. You cannot know too many people. I say this to young people. You cannot know too many people because you open doors for yourself, but somebody who likes you and respects you can open up unimagined doors for you. And finally, pay the price, the law of sow and reap. Real quickly, it pays to be just a little bit better. In 2002, I was interested in what's the difference, Brian, between the number one and number 10 golfer for 18 holes. Number one golfer, guy by the name of Tiger Woods, averaged 68.56 shots. Number 10 golfer, guy by the name of Sergio Garcia, he averaged 70 shots. What does that mean? It means that Tiger Woods would beat Sergio Garcia by an average of 1.5 shots when they played 18 holes. Why is that important? Tiger Woods made $6.9 million that year. Sergio Garcia, $2.2 million. Neither won a bad payday. But the company, a company called Nike, you may have heard of them, gave Tiger Woods a $60 to $80 million marketing contract because he was the number one golfer. The point I'm making is I say to young people, anything you can do to make yourself a little bit better, do it because it pays immensely. Those are my thoughts.
Oh, those are great. And that list is really a personal operations manual. I think if we go back and just grab, you can grab the transcript, grab the text, listen to that last segment by Barry again, and just make a list of those and make that your personal operating manual, that will set you up for success, however you define it. Barry, your book, GPS for Success, is truly a personal development textbook. And I say textbook because of the extensive research that's clearly been conducted to uncover the strategies and tactics that cause people to be successful. And I really appreciate, I think you're a learner. That has to be one of your strengths because I see how your the appendix and the resources and the quotes, and you have invested hundreds and hundreds of hours, years and decades in creating this culminating book, GPS for Success. And I really appreciate you having written that book. What was your goal when you started writing GPS for Success?
Well, thank you very much, Brian, for your generous comments. In a nutshell, I guess to provide, as my students refer to it, as the missing course. They've read my book and they now say, Dr. Franklin, this is the course that's been missing. We learned how to learn oxidative enzymes and take blood pressures and heart rates. Yours we really enjoyed. I also wanted to write, and I say this not boasting, the most comprehensive book on achieving success ever written, or one of the most comprehensive books ever written. I wanted to put together a compendium of behavioral skills that, if carefully followed, would guarantee success. I wanted to go far beyond The Secret, which you're well aware of, Rhonda Byrne. Book sold 30 million copies. If you say, Barry, what's the take-home message? You become what you think about. Or the other book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, talks about people skills. I talked about all that in GPS for Success. My book really could be summarized by three words. If you say, believe, act, achieve. And those are the essentially what I was looking for. I wanted to write a book that had legs, that had timeless information, that kept on giving high school students, college students, early career professionals, and my hope is that it'll be my legacy. I started teaching, of course, lastly, at Central Michigan University, 2012 to 2017. Brian, after reading the students' comments about the court, it was rated number one at Central Michigan University those years, and the students' positive and complimentary comments on the course, I realized that I was filling a critical void in their educational curriculum and that I was on to something big. When the course ended, I started writing the text for future generations. And in many respects, it was the essence of all I'd learned over 40, 45 years. And I would put it analogous, hopefully I'll be around for a few years, to Randy Pausch, The Last Lecture, where he died unfortunately of pancreatic cancer at 47, but he gave a lecture about a month before he died on everything he learned about life, and he wanted to share it with his students and his colleagues. So that's, to me, what I hoped to accomplish in writing this book. And once again, I very much appreciate, especially coming from you, your generous comments. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. And it's certainly a wonderful legacy that you'll leave. And I'm sure the other 26 books are great too. I think they're more medically oriented than personal and professional development oriented. But I know this one because I've read it cover to cover. I have pages dog-eared and lots of underlines, and I'll go back because, as I said, it's a textbook. And with a textbook, you go back and you refer to it from time to time. This isn't a fiction book where you read it and you're entertained and then you close the book and move on to the next one. This book is chock full of tools and techniques and strategies that readers can use to apply in their business and personal lives. Now, we don't have time to cover everything in the book, but I do encourage our listeners and viewers to go and buy the book. The content is tremendous. I talked about the appendices alone are worth the cost of the book. One of the appendices is the list of all the books that you've read in researching, and I think there are over 100 books. And it's literally, if you're looking for a reading list of success of the very best success books ever, it's in Barry's book. And the other thing is, I think you have about 10 to 12 pages of inspirational and motivational quotes, and those are terrific too. As I said, we can't talk about the entire book, and you've given so many great strategies already. But Barry, if our listeners and viewers were only able to implement two or three of the most important strategies contained in the book, what would you advise them to do?
Let me add, and I really appreciate your to me, the quotes are wisdom soundbites of our time. Mark Sanborn, who wrote the foreword, and I think that's great. I also think the best books and the best talks are stories. And you're well aware there were lots of stories and embarrassing stories sometimes that I shared with readers. I can't give you the top three, but I will give you the top five and hope you'll accept those. Number one, find something early in your life that you're good at and you really love to do, and get somebody to pay you to do that for the rest of your life. Or if you're really successful, you pay yourself. You start your own company and you do your own thing, doing what you love. Number two, become goal-oriented. Write down your goals. I have all over the place for each day and for long-term. Number three, take action. The Tommy Hopkins, the Law of Goya. Remember, the universe rewards action, not talk. It rewards action. Sometimes I'll hold a book at a big lecture and I'll say, who wants this? And finally, somebody says, is it for free? Yeah. And somebody will run up, take it from me. Who took it from me? Brian took it from me. What did Brian do that nobody else did? He took action. He wanted it, and he took action. Number four, become a voracious reader. Jack Canfield read a book every 2 days in his prime. It improves your writing, speaking skills, critically important in your vocabulary. Your vocabulary is a barometer for your ultimate success. And lastly, if at all possible, and I did this unconsciously, early in your career, try to work with the top people that you really emulate, the people who you think, wow, I'd love to be where he is or she is 20 years from now, because you can learn an immense amount of things by working with top people. So those five.
I love that. And those are, if they're not the five, they're certainly five of the six or seven most important things that, that I would have on my list for sure. I just wanted to add one thing, and you mentioned reading, and I'm a voracious reader. I know you are. You're a voracious reader and learner. We have a phrase in our family, always learning, always growing, and our kids subscribe to that. I subscribe to that. I've tried to model that for everybody in my sphere of influence. And I alluded to this before, but one of the things to realize is the investment in a book is about $20. Sometimes it's not even that much. Sometimes it's a little more. But the thing to realize, and I said this about Barry, is what you're getting is not, and I don't know the exact page count, 200. It's not the 217 odd pages. What you're getting is four decades of reading, research, experience, and the hundreds of hours that it takes to distill the essence of all of that experience, all of that research, all of that reading into that 200 plus page book. And I think people, I don't know what it is that I think we devalue sometimes the worth of a book, because sometimes you can get a book for $10 or sometimes 99 cents on Kindle. And we think, well, it's only 99 cents. It can't be worth that much. Barry's book and probably every single book in his reading list is worth 1,000 times the cost of that book. And so just keep that in mind when you're choosing what to read and when you're choosing how to invest your time. Barry, let's connect your two areas of expertise, health and success. I think one thing a lot of people struggle with today is what I'll call life balance. In today's fast-paced world, a lot of people say they just don't have enough time to do it all, to excel in their career or business, find time to exercise, which is super important, as we talked about earlier, maintain the quality of our relationships, which you also mentioned as being important, and also that little thing called getting enough sleep. How can people achieve in all the important areas of their life and still make sure that they're maintaining a healthy lifestyle?
I must preface my response by saying a big help to me is the lady I married 52 years ago, who's put up with a lot. And occasionally over the years, you're smiling. I'd say I'm really too busy to go to the parent teacher thing. Can you go? And she would very nicely say, I'm going to burn those slides. I'm going to throw those reprints out. You're going with me. I'd always go. And I'd always feel good that I went. So I happen to marry somebody who's that's too far. To get back to your point, you're really talking about, I think, time management and how you manage your time and try to get all these things in. I love a quote, and I oftentimes say it, by Henry Ford. He said, it's been my observation that most people get ahead during the time that others waste. I think there's something really telling there. Time is precious. It's the great equalizer. Our success depends on how well we use this resource. We don't know really how much time we have. I've always been impressed when I see somebody on waiting for a plane, working on their computer, as opposed to just doing nothing or something, or in a cab ride. I've gotten used to a cab ride. I'm going to do some work on that cab ride. So those are things. Super achievers use small periods of time throughout the day to accomplish big jobs. Another example, sometimes patients say to me, do I have to do exercise all at one time? I said, no, you don't have to put the dollar bill in the piggy bank all at one time. You can put four quarters. You can do a little bit of exercise, repeat it throughout the day, and still get the benefits. What are other productivity tips? Number one, you say, Barry, give me the number one. Start the damn job, okay? Start the job. You overcome inertia, you gain momentum. A lot of times people say, wow, this is going to be so time consuming. Start the job, even if it's lousy, start the job. In fact, I'll be so bold as to say starting the job is more important than achieving it. Because if you don't start the job, you're never going to achieve it. Number two, start making to-do lists. I have to-do lists all over the place. And the reward for me is when I cross it off or highlight it, I know that that thing is done. I also include in my to-do lists, and I've been doing this for years, exercise, healthy diet, 6-7 servings of fruits. It's on my, that list is sacred. If I put it on that list, I got to do it. So I start including some things that you're talking about. Turn off the TV. Very famous mentor of Jack Canfield, W. Clement Stone, multimillionaire success guru. The first thing he told him, Jack, turn off the damn TV, okay? Or turn it off at least an hour a day. And he highlighted the fact that if you turn off your TV an hour a day and devote that time to inspirational reading or devote that time to more worthwhile things, you'll gain 9 40-hour work weeks each year. You're saving an hour each day. The Pareto principle. Many people don't realize that. I've studied the Pareto principle. It's called the 80-20 rule, and a lot of people don't realize this. 80% of your successes oftentimes come from only 20% of your efforts. So I, years ago, found out, what is that 20% that I really get the biggest bang for the buck? Sometimes I'll do those things on the evenings or weekends. Lastly, I'll share with you a secret that I seldom tell anybody, but this works. It's not even in my book. If something's important and has to be done and included in your day, what I've gotten in the habit of doing is making it a password on my computer, which I'm in and out of all throughout the day. When I wanted to get GPS for Success done, what was my password? GPS, the number sign for success. And that subconsciously activated me. Oh, that's something I got to do today. I got to write a paragraph and so on and so forth. So all those kinds of things can enable you to do anything you want to do, whether it's physical activity, whether it's relationship building, whatever. Those are the keys.
Those are fantastic. I'm smiling because the password secret that you gave, I thought that was my secret.
Oh, did you?
I've thought about that. And so I teach about a broader concept, which we've alluded to, if not talked about specifically, the idea of surrounding yourself with success. And so most people think about surrounding ourselves with people, and you've mentioned that specifically, but it also includes environment. So what kind of environment are we working in? That's surrounding ourselves with success. And the very simple example I give is the same one that you just did, your password. And so you've mentioned action orientation 2 or 3 or maybe more times. What if your password was action now? And so every time you keyed in your password, you keyed in action now, action now, action now. You do that 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 times a day. And of course, as you know, that seeps into your subconscious and you're more prone to taking action now because of that one little simple technique. And you know, it's not the huge changes. We talked earlier about how do you go from hamburgers and French fries to 6 or 8 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. It's not a 100% black to white transformation. It's little by little by little, just taking a little step, a baby step. And you've heard the question, how do you eat an elephant? And we all know it. One bite at a time. That's the way you have to do it. And so any little thing that we can do to move us toward the direction of our desired results is worth doing. And that password suggestion that you gave is spot on. So I appreciate that.
I certainly agree with your point for action. And even in my book, I read a book years ago. I forgot the author, but it said The Ultimate Success Secret. The ultimate success secret, and they made a very compelling case, was taking action. It's not just, hey, it's my strategic plan. Let me think about this. It's taking action. It's getting up out of your seat. We're coming down to the podium to take the book away from me, which I think really makes the point. Taking action, number one.
And I wholeheartedly agree with that. I've said numerous times, and I've tried to pin you down on give me two or three. And there are so many things that go into success, however we define it, whether we're talking about health or fitness or relationships or finances, career success, business success. But the number one, if gun to my head, I had to just say one thing, it's absolutely take action. Brian Tracy says, action now, action now, action now. And he's absolutely right.
There's another guy by the name of A.L. Williams, Art Williams. And he's a billionaire living in Florida now in the philanthropic community. But he says, your life is not about what you say you're going to do, it's what you do. And that it really is so true.
Yep. Absolutely.
We're so much on the same page.
Clearly. Barry, our show, as you know, is called Life Excellence. And I'm curious, with your vast experience and knowledge, what does excellence mean to you?
Excellence to me is achieving, in many respects, your highest potential and having no limits. In other words, if you think you can do it, you can do it. I'll give you an example. A guy by the name of Roger Bannister. Roger Bannister in the 50s ran a mile under 4 minutes. The medical community said, it's physiologically impossible, can't be done. Roger Bannister said, I'm going to take a half a second off this month. I'm going to take a second off this month by making my quads stronger, this wind resistance. Roger Bannister beat the 4 minute a mile. And the next year, 220 some young runners around the world beat it as well, because he took that mentality that you can't do it and showed you could do it. That's critically important. Set no limits.
I love it. Barry, thank you so much for being on the show today. It's wonderful to speak with you, and I'm so grateful for your time today.
Brian, thanks for the opportunity. Love talking with you, and we should get together offline and pursue this a little bit more.
Thank you, Barry. Thanks for tuning into Life Excellence. Please support the show by subscribing, sharing it with others, posting about today's show with Dr. Barry Franklin on social media, and leaving a rating and review. You can learn more about me at brianbartus.com. Until next time, dream big dreams and make each day your masterpiece.